Welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast from ExchangeWire, bringing you the latest news and views from the world of ad tech, media, and marketing.
Hello and welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast. We've got a team episode today. I'm editor at ExchangeWire, Amy Neal-Turin, and I'm here with CEO Rachel Smith. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you very much, Amy. Delighted to be here.
How are you?
I'm very good, thank you.
Good, good. And we're also here with Lindsay Rountree, COO.
Hello.
Hey, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good. Okay. So today we'll be discussing a call from UK broadcasters for the government to stamp out big tech's anti-competitive behaviour, WPP forging a new partnership, plus a look at what's going on in the DSP landscape. So first, focusing on the UK. Sky News, BBC and ITN have joined the News Media Association in calling UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer to back the Competition and Markets Authority in its effort to stamp out the tech platform's anti-competitive behaviour. The broadcasters' leaders sent Starmer a letter warning of the risks that unregulated AI tools are posing to the global information system. They urged the government to take urgent action to prevent the digital ecosystem from becoming overwhelmed by misinformation and disinformation, including giving the CMA its full backing and asking ministers to give unconditional support to the creative sectors. Rachel, what reaction do you expect from Keir Starmer and his government?
Well, interestingly, I thought this was actually much more of a story around regulation in the world of AI than it is on curtailing big tech companies. It's certainly, you know, there's certainly an anti-competitive angle to it, but actually I think what we're really looking at is what the current regulatory controls look like around things like copyright, both from a creative point of view and also from, news, journalist, authored original content point of view. And I think that what we're going to find is that the government, I think most certainly, I'm not really sure if this particular plea from UK broadcasters is necessarily a thing that will bring them to the table, but I think there's no chance that the government isn't sitting around thinking about ways in which they can regulate AI search, AI, any companies that are building an LLM, any AI search results being filtered into regular, search engine results, because it's just having such a big impact on society. It's for sure having a massive impact on publishers and content providers, including broadcasters. So obviously, BBC, ITV and Sky have put forward some, points well made. They're not saying that developments in AI have necessarily entirely harmed their businesses. They're talking about how it's really sped up the, efficiency of a lot of the tasks that they have to undertake on a daily basis. But what they're really fighting for here is some kind of recognition of copyright infringement and the ability to operate a mixed and diverse monetization model. So actually I see it as more of a story around how do we put some suitable guardrails around AI tools and the behaviour shift that we're seeing in the general population moving from, regular search and traditional search into AI search, and what is that going to look like for the providers of that content. So I think the government will be hugely, they have to already be doing some work on this, otherwise they're totally incompetent. So let's hope they are.
Well, I mean,
yeah, I know, eyebrows raised in all directions. And it's interesting, that BBC and ITV and Sky used the kind of CMA as the lever to put this argument forward. So I do think that's an interesting angle. If that's what's needed to get them to come to the table and really take this seriously, I can't believe they're not taking it seriously, but I guess what they need to do is commit a certain amount of resource to understanding the existing legislative landscape and what they can reasonably do to kind of contain and control how information is used to be fed into LLMs that then regurgitate, content results for consumers. So, if that's what needs to be done to get the government to sort of sit up and pay appropriate amounts of attention and dedicate the appropriate resources to this, then fair enough. But personally, I think this is a story about regulation, pertaining to AI.
Yeah, no, definitely. Lindsay, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I completely agree with Rachel. And I think that what's interesting is the request is actually quite vague. They haven't been very specific about what they're asking for. Like, they're saying, please back the CMA and please provide support, is kind of what they're asking for. And again, I agree with you, it's about regulation. They're not specifically asking for the government to create new laws or create new regulation. Arguably, you could say they're doing that because otherwise they just might say no. And they kind of go, that's the end of that then. So if they kind of be vague about it, and they're basically, it's a big cry for help saying, please help us. Please don't ignore this. It's a real problem for the industry. And please help back the CMA. I don't know why the CMA would need backing in this context. Is the CMA not entirely sure what its remit is around AI and what is enforceable? Or does it need more resource and more budget to be able to do a full-on investigation into these companies, because it takes such resource and the CMA is you know, classically underfunded and under-resourced? So I wonder kind of if that has a role to play in what these companies, what is it, Sky, ITN and BBC are actually asking for.
Yeah.
Because you kind of, you look at the news article and you look at the letter and you sort of think, well, is this a business model play? Like, are you actually, because on the one hand, they're talking about misinformation, disinformation. On the other hand, you're sort of thinking, they're saying it's anti-competitive. Well, is that because it's affecting your business model? Well, it isn't affecting the BBC's business model, because they haven't got a business model like that because they're publicly funded. So, what? And again, I think that's why it's a bit confusing and a bit vague. And I get they probably just want to be able to put their names out there and say, look, we back... trying to, and they admitted, you know, we do use AI in our businesses and we do use it to try and help us do our jobs better. And I think it's exactly what you said, Rachel, it's guardrails. They're putting out a general plea for better guardrails around AI in our industry. But I don't know if the lack of specifics in what they're actually asking for in this, but the lack of specifics in how it's affecting them or the industry might make it more complicated and more confusing, because I think everyone's coming at it from a different angle.
I think connected to that, Lindsay, which is a really important point, is that if what they're trying to do is go down the anti-competition route and trying to put piece together an argument suggesting that the owners of tech platforms who are developing effectively a replacement for search and turning it into AI search, the owners of those platforms are dominating, their businesses are dominant, they are replacing the channels via which they would typically get search referral traffic. That's hugely impacting their businesses and their business models. You're right, it doesn't apply to the BBC. Well, certainly not in this country. I suppose you could argue globally it might do. But if that's the argument they're putting forward, they need to be much more specific about that.
Yeah.
And as we know from watching what's going on in the US with the anti-competition cases put to Google, you can't just go in there with a vague claim that this is affecting my business model. You really have to go in there with some hardcore evidence about how you've built your business model, about how these businesses have built their business model, about what impact that's had on your business model, and about how they are blocking out the competition. At the moment, I don't think there's enough clarity around the ways in which everybody's using AI search for them to be able to piece together a suitable argument on that front. So instead, they seem to be changing tack to, well, not changing tack, they seem to be sort of also using the, you know, the thread of, well, you know, this is also in the best interests of society at large, because you don't want lots of disinformation out there, and you don't want us to be living in an environment where the majority of the content on the internet is not necessarily verified and is not necessarily trustworthy. All of that's totally true, but I think that's a completely different matter.
It is, exactly.
To anti-competition. So I think you're right, Lindsay, you've picked up on a good point. The letter isn't clear on their claims, so I think they probably could do with being a bit more targeted, because if you're trying to get the attention of the Prime Minister and you're trying to get attention of the ruling government, you really need to be very specific about what it is you want their help and support with. Otherwise, it'll just go in the big pile of letters they've no doubt got from various other interest groups about what's not working and things that they need to fix. So, yeah, they should be really thinking about the most powerful way to get this message across and to get people's attention, to get the government's attention.
I totally agree, because I think misinformation and disinformation is so hard to regulate against. And, you know, it's obvious what the issue for them is. People are starting to use the LLMs as search functions, for search functions, and then they are seeing content that is linked to source, but no one's clicking on it. You know, bring back Google News, all is forgiven. Like, imagine a publisher sort of saying, actually, I prefer the old model where Google News used to kind of, like, have all the control, but at least we got traffic, at least we got revenue from that traffic. Yeah. But of course now, if that's effectively defunding journalism because the traffic isn't coming through anymore, which again, as we said, does not affect the BBC because it's not ad-funded, but it is affecting the general journalistic publishing industry and economy more generally. If it's defunding journalism and then basically creating an information void, that void is going to be filled with more AI slop, and that then creates a kind of an economic disaster because what information is true or not. But that's been true. Like, disinformation, misinformation has been the case for a long time. That we've been going after the social platforms about that for a decade at least. So, and not much has really happened in this country from successive UK governments to fix that. So I don't know how they would feel they'd be able to tackle this in this case, especially as you said, Rachel, if they aren't coming to the government with specifics about how it's impacting our businesses, this is what you can do to help fix it. They're not going to do anything about it.
Yeah. And one thing I thought when I was reading this article is that actually I'd mentioned this to somebody last week. I feel like we're moving closer and closer to a world where social media platforms need a sort of a different designation, right? They've long argued they're just technology platforms. That's all they are. That's all they do is provide the platform. Everything else that happens on the platform is no responsibility of theirs, and they've got, you know, that they don't get involved with it at all. And we've obviously seen certainly this year, we've seen a lot of social media platforms completely getting rid of content moderation as a tool.
Yeah.
And I feel like now we're in the world where we do need to be thinking about a different designation for those businesses. I can understand why they argue they're not publishers because they haven't actually originated the content, but they have become publishing platforms. And so they do need to be held to some kind of standard and some kind of regulation that ensures that the content that appears on their platform is genuine. And, you know, I'm sure they'd all argue that they have got their own, you know, individually invented standards to ensure, because these are the sorts of arguments that they'd be putting forward to advertisers all the time. Actually, no, this is a premium environment. We can show you lots of demographic information about the people that are on our platform, and there's all these sorts of things that we put in place to make sure it's a brand safe environment, blah, blah. But ultimately, I feel like there needs to be another layer of responsibility that they take on here so that they are incentivized to think, well, yeah, actually, we need to, if content is appearing on our platform that is allegedly verified and provided by a journalist that's paid by the BBC, we need to make sure that that's actually true. And I don't know what that would look like, but there needs to be something in between. Because, you know, where I'm coming from here is that prior to digital and even the early days of digital, publishers have always been held to account by particular laws and particular standards that mean that they have, and codes of conduct that means that they can't make allegations about things or people or places or events that are untrue. And that's what's missing. You know, if we are then consuming most of our content via some internet channel, an LLM, any kind of search model that doesn't show us verified results, then we're in this kind of limbo where we're not actually operating in a verified environment. No one's really taking responsibility for that. Sure, there might be some link sources, but you also don't know if those results that are being returned to you in an LLM environment are accurate, right? So, you know, yeah, I feel like there's a layer of designation that needs to be, that somewhere in between tech platform and publisher, that social media or broadcast platforms need to be, you know, sort of defined by.
Yeah, because also, ultimately, they are monetizing content they didn't write.
Absolutely.
And the people that wrote it are getting nothing.
And that's always been
what it boils down to.
That's right. And that's always been the issue, yeah. Right? That was the issue with the internet that we've got. That's becoming even more chronic now. And it's not just about how we make that monetization model stack up for publishers. It's also about how do we ensure that consumers are consuming good quality content, or at least, you know, genuine, truthful, verified content. Someone's got to take some responsibility for that in there somewhere.
Yeah.
And it can't just be a set of government rules and regulations, because then we start having a conversation about enforcement. Well, what does enforcement look like? So what are the penalties?
This is it, because laws have already been broken. Like, the copyright infringement's already happened, yet no one's enforcing it. So actually there's ground to enforce, but that can't happen. Or it can happen, but it isn't happening, likely due to resource again.
So we need to be in a world or in an environment where there are some large corporations and entities, i.e. what we currently define as big tech platforms, who, you know, have to take responsibility for some of that, because in order not to take responsibility for that and to run the risk that you might wind up in the face of legislators is just too expensive, right? So because that's what we've currently got with publishers and broadcasters. So tech platforms need to be, like I said, in some kind of different sphere of legal designation that makes that possible.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
And just going further into the copyright issue, do you think we could see the UK government introduce stricter measures sort of in favour of publishers with copyright? Because obviously from what they've introduced previously with like the opt-out thing, like creatives were quite upset with that and they weren't happy with that. Do you think, what the creative industry would think is like more in favour of creatives, do you think we could see regulation more kind of in that direction? Or do you think it's like they're just going to do it in a way that the creatives are still not satisfied with?
They might never be satisfied, yeah. I think is my fear. I think that also, you know, with the opt-out you mentioned, I think that there's going to be, I hate to kind of like be cynical about it, but there's going to be a world in which big tech ultimately always sort of wins. So yeah. they probably will win in this regard. Whatever decision happens or whatever is actually enforced likely won't be big enough or strong enough to cause the big tech companies in this case to actually be negatively affected. And you look at the precedent of how big tech companies have been fined in the past. It's a drop in the ocean for them. It doesn't really mean very much. So you wonder that whatever kind of actually happens here won't be any kind of enforcement for actual existing infringements won't kind of move the needle. It'll need to be a law change that stops it from happening in the first place, but that arguably is never going to happen either.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. If you're talking about, artists, creators, how they protect and copyright their work, this is a huge issue that has really been with us since the dawn of time. You know, if we think about the early days of distributing that type of content for writers via publishers, for recording artists via record companies or whatever, there's always been huge issues around the contractual ownership of, you know, the intellectual property and how money gets returned to those artists and how that gets protected from being reproduced. So I think this is just another iteration of that, only like everything that we're dealing with at the moment, we're talking about this in a much higher volume than we've ever needed to consider it beforehand. So I think it's pretty powerful that you've had artists like Elton John coming out saying, honestly, we need to do something with copyright law because this just really isn't fair. And so I do think that push is going to continue from the perspective of recording artists and, actors and any kind of creative industries, and as it should. I'm just not sure, like you said, Lindsay, I'm not really sure what the solution will look like. Again, if I think back to the early days of Spotify, pre-Spotify, what was it, Napster, you know, the whole idea was that was pirated content that was made available in a digital environment for as many people as wanted to download it. And then, of course, they became a legitimate business and then you had to pay. And then, you know, many years later, we wound up with other streaming platforms like Spotify. And the argument in the early days was not enough money's getting returned to the artist. How do we make sure that work doesn't get reproduced or redistributed elsewhere where people don't pay? And we all know the examples of turning up at a party where there's a Spotify playlist, turns out you're actually supposed to pay to distribute that
licensing
playlist.
You're supposed
to pay a licensing fee to use those playlists in a public setting, in a public environment. How is that ever enforced? So I think this is a step on from that age-old argument, but I wonder if we might start to get more groundswell behind artists' push to protect their own work and their intellectual property, because we're all starting to be concerned about the quality of content being reduced down to something that's not worth consuming. You know, the argument goes, if artists aren't making enough money from producing their art, then they're going to stop producing art, and we'll live in a world where everything is just manufactured, you know, via something that's not necessarily human-centred, and it won't really be very good quality, and nobody really wants to live in that environment, right?
But we sort of already do in the music industry. Like, you know, we talk about Spotify as being kind of the gold standard. The money everyone gets on Spotify is absolute shit. Lily Allen famously came out and said, I get more money from putting my feet on OnlyFans than I do from the millions of streams I get per year on Spotify, like millions of streams for some of her songs. And she's obviously in the news at the moment for different reasons.
Yes.
But, you know, that kind of
all of
really
her
gives
songs.
You a... All of her songs, yeah, absolutely. absolutely. But that gives you an idea of kind of like we've sort of settled with that.
Yeah.
And in the music industry, you can at least go on tour. And that is why so many artists are touring, because that's how they make their revenue, because they aren't making it from selling records anymore, because it's not a thing. Well, a journalist can't do that. They can't go on a tour and go, come and hear me read my best article. To the O2 or Wembley. Yeah.
But you say that, I am finding myself following social media accounts of particular journalists in the same way that I might do comedians or, you know, artists, because I'm interested in the things that they write. So, you know, maybe we're not a world away from journalists setting up their own accounts, saying, if you want to follow me and read the articles that I post, here's my, you know, you can pay to access this content. I don't know.
I didn't think we'd get so much leverage out of that story, honestly. We've gone for about 25 minutes. Podcast over. Thanks for listening, guys. Bye. See you next week.
Yeah, no, that's interesting, though. I think it was moving in that direction, definitely. And now let's have a look at the agency landscape. So WPP has partnered with analytics firm Sightly to tap its brand mentality platform, which provides content target suggestions based on what marketers want their brands to be associated with, allowing brands to align with social and news content that complements their brand identity. The partnership reflects a wider trend of agencies harnessing AI to help brands to help themselves. So what similar deals have we been seeing recently, Lindsay?
I feel like in the agency world, we're seeing a lot of moves into AI, a lot of different acquisitions. Also, you know, you could argue that you could put the IPG Omnicom deal in there somewhere. Like everyone's trying to make moves that make them future-proof. And I think that this one's a very interesting one because it ties in with a move we've been talking about for a very, very long time and claim we're doing, but aren't really, from brand safety to the goal of brand suitability, which is rather than having to use keyword blocking, I can actually kind of use context, which is companies around forever doing context, but this actually kind of, I suppose, makes it more effective. But I think that we've seen publicists make big moves in AI development. One of the first to do, in fact, the first to do so, I think, in terms of the big holdcos. WPP are a little bit maybe, well, they have been making some, they have done some other acquisitions, I think, in the aerospace, but this is quite a big one from a brand safety perspective. But I think that Core AI is what I'm thinking of. Core AI Publicis was the big one that they did, and obviously they've had their AI platform they've had for about, I can't remember how long it's been now, but it's been a long time that they're developing this. And I feel like they probably will continue to do so because they feel they have to keep differentiating and have to keep making moves because all the tech platforms are investing heavily in AI, and the brands want to see that, and the brands are investing heavily in AI. If the agencies don't keep up, they could be disintermediated because it's like, well, if you're not using AI to run our campaigns, kind of what good are you? We'll go straight to the tech partner or we'll do it ourselves. And so that's what we're probably seeing a big trend of at the moment.
Yeah, a lot of heavy investment in AI, definitely. Rachel, what are your thoughts?
So, yeah, I mean, I agree with you, Lindsay. Like, there's plenty of evidence that suggests that agencies really feel the need to keep up from a tech and AI point of view. So even if we look at other deals that agencies have done over the past 12 months, even things like Publicis' acquisition of Losamy on the data side, you know, they're really getting serious about understanding that they need to be providing the maximum amount of support for their clients along some of the key sort of threads that are running through digital advertising and marketing at the moment. And that is obviously data. Everything needs to be powered by good quality data, and AI would be the second one. So I think what's interesting about this one is that it's going to potentially offer something that I guess, you know, this is just my outsider's read of it, is sort of a replacement of the traditional brand study, right? This is something that can be produced much faster, you know, arguably more accurately, who knows, using real-time data. You know, it's bringing in data from social media as well as from, you know, news outlets and platforms. It's really focused on that cultural positioning element of advertising. So, you know, what kind of cultural moments do you want to align yourself with as a brand? I think that all of that type of stuff is the kind of thing that people imagine AI can help them do. So having a tool like this that is able to produce some kinds of brand study that's much more live and real time is something I would think would appeal massively to brands. And they would, I would assume, naturally want their agency to be able to take control of this. So like Lindsay said, if an agency obviously isn't at the ready to be able to do some of these things or experiment with their own in-house AI tools and platforms to do something similar, then brands are just going to go to technology companies directly, or they're going to try to find ways to do it themselves. So, you know, it makes total sense. And I think it's another sort of indicator of the direction that we're seeing agencies go in. They're doing, I think, two things simultaneously: consolidating. So we've seen WP do that, consolidating the number of agencies within the whole co and how those agencies are focused, and acquiring very specific tools to make that advertising and marketing execution all the more real for brands, all the more powerful. And this is another example of that, I think.
I think what we might see as well, which we've seen, you know, with a lot of the big tech platforms, we've seen some layoffs happening recently. And there's a lot of assumption, a lot of talk around the fact that the layoffs are happening because AI is replacing them. And actually, when you dig into it, it looks like layoffs are happening so they can invest that money into AI instead. You might see the same across the agencies, that they decide to have a round of layoffs to help invest in the right things again to future-proof themselves. And WPP have had
This has been happening all morning, Lindsay, right from the visit to the patisserie. It's not been going well for you.
No, it's not. It's not. I still can't say it.
Lindsay had a problem with maple and pecan.
Maple and people. Maple and people. But oh my God, maple and pecan. That's not right, is it? Maple and pecan.
Correct. Yay.
Yeah, anyway, what was I trying to say?
Back to WPP.
I think that they are, you may see some layoffs, and I think that you're going to see, you know, they've not had the best year. They had what was it, 74% drop in profits, in pre-tax profits in H1, and they are trying to find ways to still be relevant in a world where the whole co's are really diversifying and really kind of, pubs in particular, have been storming it the past few years. And WPP used to be number one, and they're like, you know, what are we now? So I think that these kind of acquisitions could be a way of them making themselves relevant to potential and existing clients.
Yeah. And, you know, they have a new CEO, and I guess this is, you know, time for a bit of a reset and refocus. And exactly as you've described, Lindsay, I just think that having some kind of impressive AI functionality is now becoming table stakes for agencies. Brands will be expecting it. If I think back to AI conversations at ATS Singapore, I'm going to say at least 2 years ago, possibly even 3 years ago, when we first started talking about that as a subject on stage at ATS. And it was all the agencies that were doing impressive things. There was, of course, you know, a tech vendor that really wanted to talk about it, or maybe two tech vendors that really wanted to talk about it. But it was all the agencies that were really experimenting with it, and they were being pushed by their clients to do that. And also, too, because they've got a lot of in-house expertise at what can we do with the data? What can we do with, you know, brands' outcomes and key performance indicators? And how can we carve all this up? And what technology tools can we use to help us do this differently, help us do it faster, you know, enable us to do it differently? So it's not surprising.
No. Yeah, lots more. We'll see, I'm sure. And now moving on to our last section. So we're going to be discussing an ExchangeWire article by one of our columnists, Shirley Marshall, looking at the DSP wars. So we've been seeing a lot of action across the DSP landscape. It's becoming more and more noisy. Although Amazon's DSP wasn't a major part of the conversation until recently, now there's a DSP war between Amazon, Google, and the Trade Desk. And so according to Shirley Marshall in this article, may the cheapest one win. So what do you make of what we've been seeing, Rachel, in the DSP landscape over the past year or so?
Yeah, so I think this is super interesting, Amy, especially because we talked about it on stage at ATS London earlier this year. It was mentioned in a number of panel discussion sessions. I sort of reflected on it a little bit in my opening presentation, looking at a couple of Mad Tech sketches that we'd produced throughout the year that were looking at the technology layer in the industry, what we keep referring to as the infrastructure layer, which I would categorize as DSPs, SSPs, not SSTs.
They're the old SSTs, absolutely.
They're to be found with the maple and the pecans. DSPs, SSPs, you know, maybe some kind of basic layer of data infrastructure in there. That's kind of like the sort of foundational layer of ad tech. And now we're starting to see lots of other tech tools and solutions in and around that foundational layer. And those Mad Tech sketches were a bit of a presentation of how we see the technology landscape unfolding in the coming 12 to 18 months. And we put forward a number of sort of arguments, hypotheses. One of them was about the modularization of ad tech. So basically choosing technology tools and solutions in a modular fashion rather than feeling like you've got to go all in with a particular, with a particular vendor that's taking you down a particular walled garden route. So this lends itself into what we see is happening at the DSP layer in the industry at the moment. So first and foremost, I love Shirley's articles. If you're listening, Shirley, love your articles.
Really good.
Keep writing. She writes some really good articles. She's got a great tone and manner in her articles. I love the way she broke down the sort of recent history of DSPs in the industry, because really we're talking about 8 years ago, huge consolidation on that infrastructure layer where we had a number of DSPs, and it's all kind of really whittled away to these main players. Google's been dominant for a long period of time. Shirley makes the point in her article. They've been kind of quiet, especially over the last 12 months, because they're facing anti-competition heat in the US, but probably also they're not quite licking their wounds, but they're probably just trying not to be too prominent after all of the cookie shenanigans.
Keep a low profile.
Exactly.
Keep on the radar for a while.
Totally. You won't notice us. Let's try and like stir up some beef between the others.
That's exactly
in the background.
Right.
I think it's, well, that's what they're doing.
It's almost like they got really drunk at the party and they woke up the next day and went, oh, embarrassing. I might that's just like
keep it low profile
for a little while on all of the cookie stuff. But also they'd have been hugely distracted with all of that cookie stuff as well. So they've just kind of, their DSP business probably has just been rolling along. No doubt they're busy, as Shirley makes the point in her article, they're probably busy doing other things behind the scenes to beef it up, to make it, a compelling offer. And it is still, let's not deny it, a very compelling offer for brands and marketers. In the meantime, Amazon's DSP is really fired up, where it was kind of a sleeping giant for a little while they were busy focused on their gargantuan sized business on everything retail. And now they're in a position where they've got all this fantastic retail data from their standalone regular Amazon business and all the Prime Video data as well. And now they've got a really compelling advertising offering. It might not be, super high quality compared with other DSPs, but it's really functional. It's got an enormous amount of data. And then we look at the Trade Desk, the independent darlings of the industry, shall I call them, because I still remember the very early days of the Trade Desk coming out. Jeff Green launched that business at a time where there was plenty of DSPs in the market.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people probably thought he was nuts launching a new DSP, thinking that was going to be a winner of a business. And it has turned out to be a winner of a business. And it's done that off the back of stating its claim of independence. We are the DSP that you want to use when you want to reach people in the open web. We're not a walled garden, et cetera, et cetera. So now we've got this really interesting landscape where Amazon, Google, very clear walled gardens, Trade Desk kind of borderline, right? Like it's still independent. It's still mostly focusing on the open web, but they've been trying to develop new products and tools that would sort of lend to a slight walled garden offering, trying to keep people within their ecosystem. And I just think that it means that brands and buyers are probably looking at their options and wondering, quite frankly, well, which customers and which potential audiences am I going to reach depending on which DSP I'm going to use? So walled gardens are always going to have some relevance depending on what type of inventory they're offering access to and what type of audiences, rather, they're offering access to. But I do think lots of brands and buyers will be looking for an independent solution. And the Trade Desk isn't quite as independent as it was, even 5-6 years ago, just because it's become very competitive and one of the main DSPs. And like I said, is, trying to develop other products and tools along the way to keep people locked into their ecosystem, whether that's UDID or whatever else it might be. So I think there's room in the market for what I would refer to as modular options. So DSPs for trying to reach particular audiences, using a DSP just for particular types of execution, trying to reach, if you're a brand, particular types of outcomes, maybe using it partnered with a particular data solution that's going to offer extra data to help you find that audience. And I think Shirley's main point is 100% bang on here, which is that it will come down to cost. So whilst brands want quality, cost will be the deciding factor, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, Lindsay, how anti-competitive do you think the behaviour that we've been seeing from the major DSPs is?
Well, I'd like to take a moment to make the obvious comparison between the DSP wars and the Chinese economy.
Such an obvious comparison.
Because, well, obviously. So at the moment, I've been reading The Economist because I'm very highbrow. At the moment, there's something happening in the Chinese economy that I find really interesting. And it's happened before. But basically, there is a massive, massive race to the bottom among major brands, like normally sort of retail brands, like consumer brands, there's like an ice cream store that sells ice cream for like 10 cents or whatever, trying to get people the door. But basically... And she's like, oh, there's an alarm going off outside. Wonderful.
Yes, so I think you should carry on
talking. I'll just carry on talking about the Chinese economy.
Yeah.
So the connection with the Chinese economy is that there's a word that they have, which I'm going to butcher. It's called Neijuan. And the Chinese speaker opposite me is probably going to be making a face at that. But it's called...
She's
laughing her head off. But it's involution. And what it basically means is that image of that snake kind of like eating its own tail.
Yes,
so what's happening with the race to the bottom is all these companies are desperate to increase their market share. So they're all lowering their prices massively in a bid to increase market share. And what's happening is no one's market share is increasing. It's great for consumers. You would think it's from the outside looking, it's great for consumers because it is... giving them cheaper prices to access, cheaper access to goods. That's really good for them. But actually, the companies are now registering less profits, less revenue, less profits. It's actually affecting wage increases. And it's affecting employment, and there's been layoffs. And of course, the big problem here is the CCP, and now it's affecting them as well because there's less money coming into the economy. And it's all for this plight of trying to get the most market share. And, you know, there is definitely a parallel here in terms of what's happening with Race to the Bottom. And certainly kind of the big battle here is between Amazon and the trade desk. And, you know, a lot's kind of sort of been kind of coming to the fore, and things seem to be getting a little bit nasty between them over the past sort of few days, with Amazon basically coming out directly and saying, compare us to your DSP, your main DSP. And they really mean the trade desk. They probably obviously mean Google as well, but they're sort of saying, we'll do a direct comparison. We'll pay for the test. We'll do everything. Run both of us side by side for 6 weeks and let's see what's better. And the traders have come out and said, we would definitely welcome a fair comparison, but they feel a bit like it's not like... Yeah, and also they're not coming out saying, yeah, we'll definitely win this, guys. Come on, let's go on board. They say we very much welcome a fair comparison because they obviously feel that the odds are probably stacked against them. But also, if you look at the partnerships between Amazon and the trade desk,
both kind of partner with everybody,
which means there's no real winner. They one side's partnered. Amazon's partnered with like one set of streaming platforms, and including Roku and Netflix, and the trade desk have done the other side. So there's no real kind of like leader in that perspective. And then when it comes to costs, Amazon are just reducing their prices constantly, and they're up to a third of the cost of. The trade desk, which if you're really after, as Shirley says in her article, it's going to come to cost. If that's what really your concern is, and for most people, it absolutely is. And if you get any sort of procurement person, like marketing procurement expert, involved in this conversation, they are absolutely going to choose cost every single time, and often not bring other things, like to take it very much out of context. They'll just go and look at cost and go, well, that's the obvious answer. Ignore the fact that, you know, the trade desks, is it Kokai? K-O-K-A-I, their AI tool, is actually genuinely delivering really strong results. Like, that's obviously very, very important. But if a trade desk is charging 15% and Amazon are charging as little as 4%, like...
It's not... I think that brings us back to also the basis of this, which is you're not competing in a level playing field there, right? Like, you know, the argument goes that the trade desk's fees are what they are because they're an independent company. They're nowhere near the size of Amazon as a company. You know, no, it might be different
Amazon
in terms
just
of just comparing their DSPs.
Amazon just baby wipes and they're sorted.
Exactly. So, you know, they can afford... And if you really looked at the numbers, no doubt... The rest of Amazon's business will be underwriting the DSP because otherwise how can they get away with those kinds of fees? Obviously what they're hoping is they'll get volume, and over time once they get enough volume then that will stack up. But part of that volume will depend on knocking their competitors out of the marketplace, right? Yeah. Meanwhile, you know, yes, if we talk about what's good for consumers, because if we go back to the Chinese comparison, like you said, very natural comparison.
Obviously natural parallel there.
What is best for the consumers? Well, in this instance, let's imagine the consumers are the brands who are actually wanting to use the DSPs. What's best for them? See, there's another layer here, right? I'd have thought it is trying to find the audience and the potential consumers that they're looking for. Now, whilst advertising metrics are still what they are these days, and you know the quality of performance is measured the way that it is, then unfortunately, as I said earlier on, although lots of brands will argue they want quality, they're after quality, actually they're chasing lower costs because that makes things stack up for them better. And in a performance market, they're still going to get great results. Probably from 4% fee on Amazon versus a 50% fee on the Trade Desk. So, you know, that makes it, I would argue, an unfair, you know, Amazon have got an unfair advantage, and it's not a level playing field. It's not fair competition.
No, I totally agree with you.
And it, you know, who's the decider there? What will happen in the Chinese economy? Because that's a really interesting example to me. It sounds like a, you know, lesson in what is it called that we all live in? Capitalism.
Thank you.
Wow. Yeah.
A lesson in capitalist economics. It certainly is a race to the bottom for those businesses involved, because they'll eventually just all collapse in on one another, and there'll be consolidation, and only a few will survive. But that's very common in capitalist economies. We see that happen all the time, right? Because, you know, it's market dynamics, and consumers will just keep following what is most cost effective. And so the period of hot competition is probably the best for consumers, because they're getting more, they're getting better prices, and they're getting, you know, a wider range of products. Eventually, those companies go bust, costs go back up again, bad times for consumers, and then we just kind of keep going round in circles. So something kind of similar is happening in the world of ad tech, except it's not as straightforward. And the consumers are not regular consumers. They are buyers of advertising inventory.
Yeah. And in the case of China, the government will eventually step in and go, guys, could you stop, please? Because it's actually really annoying us.
Yeah.
Whereas no one's going to do that in this instance.
No.
The brands will, if they're not getting what they want out of it. But if you compare what this looks like from a tech perspective, where tech does the work, and you know, more and more AI is doing the work. Yes, of course, there are loads of people involved, and those people are fundamentally very, very important. But compare that to the, you know, I remember back in my early agency days, there was an agency race to the bottom, and every pitch was won on numbers. Every pitch was won on fee. Like, it didn't matter what you brought to the table. Like, if you offered 5%, the one next to you would offer 4%. I remember it went as low as 0.5%, to the point where then the next agency went, we won't offer any fee unless we get results. And that then caused the brands to go to agencies and go, listen,
do you want to pay
for
results?
Yeah, we will pay you like very, very generous fees if you hit these targets. Oh, but by the way, if I remember this, it was a very large airline that came to us and did this. But by the way, if anything happens in the macroeconomic environment that affects our sales, you won't get any money for that either. So you had no control over what's going on. Like, if there was some kind of airline emergency, or like, you know, if COVID happened, for example, and all flights were grounded, that's it. That's the end of your fee. You're not getting anything, because it's out of your control completely. Nothing to do with the advertising you're trying to run, but we have the control here. So you could argue that the where the control lies could actually shift, which could make it look quite interesting.
Yeah, no, well, and I think that is what's already happening, right? Like, you know, one could argue that that's somewhat happening on the buy side of the industry, but I think brands still don't really feel like they've got sufficient control over the advertising value chain to really vote with their feet, as
no,
we might say.
Not for the majority, no.
But I do think that it is slowly changing, and that's where I think modular ad tech plays a role, because there will be some brands that will be prepared to, especially depending on what fee structures look like, to experiment with different technology tools and solutions that take them out of that extremely competitive infrastructure technology environment. Meantime, the big guns will battle it out, and we wait to see what happens next.
Yeah. And I suppose, you know, who's going to win? There doesn't have to be there shouldn't need to be a winner, because they should all be able to operate alongside each other in a kind of a healthily competitive environment. But arguably, if you're a brand, you might decide you want to use all three, because actually they might offer different things for you. You know, Amazon has got the retail backing beside it that makes it more interesting. There was I saw an article about an ad that came out. The Trade Desk have launched a bunch of ads basically saying, oh, we don't have any kind of skin in the game. We don't own an e-commerce platform. We don't own this. We have no conflict of interest. Didn't mention Amazon, obviously, but they were going after Amazon. And of course, there's been lots of conversation in their earnings calls, even the one back in January of this year, where they are asked continuously, do you see Amazon DSP as a competitor? Mm. And the first time around, they said, we've not seen it as a competitor. And iExchanger at the time actually wrote, lol, because they are. Yeah. And then the August one, after when they had saw the massive share price drop, which you could argue was related to comments about Amazon, they said that Amazon operates in a very different space from us. They didn't say they're not a competitor. Mm. They said they have this, we have this. And of course, share prices dropped for a few ad tech companies that day. But it's been a long time coming that we're now in a position where there was a very, very clear fight between them. There's been the Trade Desk, you could argue, has been trying to stave them off for a long time. And they're now kind of like coming with their fists up saying, no, we can prove to you that we're
also because the Trade Desk is in a position where they've no choice. They really have to, it's a bit dog eat dog for them. They really have to keep battling. And
it is because they're only a Trade Desk.
Absolutely. And they really, they're a publicly listed company. They've got to satisfy their shareholders. So they need to keep going. They need to keep going head and shoulders into this competition and fight to the end. Mm. They're enabling an environment where there is room for other competitors that do something slightly different. That's what's exciting about ad tech at the moment, right? Just when you think that the big dogs are soaking everything up, when they start fighting with each other, that provides an environment where there's opportunity for alternative solutions.
It provides food for the little dogs. Underlings on the ground.
Little dogs.
Little tiny scrap of food. I've been hungry.
It's been all about dogs, pastries and the Chinese economy today.
Absolutely, yeah.
Good old Mad Tech podcast.
Yeah, no, those are some great points. Yeah, and I think that's all we have time for today. So.
You say all we have time for. You wished it ended 20 minutes ago because we have natted on. Bloody hell. Sorry, Amy.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Po. Thanks, Lindsay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rachel.
Thanks, Amy.
And thanks to everyone for listening. Tune in next week for more ad tech.
You've been listening to the Mad Tech podcast, brought to you by ExchangeWire.